Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everybody, for being here with us again today. Another Sunday morning wake-up call here on 97.9 The Wren. Today's topic is about broadband, the rural and urban digital divide. Our guest today is Professor Christopher Alley, UVA's Department of Media Studies. He has a new book out called Farm Fresh Broadband, The Politics of Rural Connectivity and the Rural-Urban Digital Divide in the United States. Professor Alley, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I picked up your book, by the way, listeners. Find it on Amazon. You can, if you can't find it locally, you might be able to find it at a UVA bookstore on top of the parking garage. You certainly could probably walk into the bookstores on the downtown mall and ask somebody to bring it in for you if they don't already have it. Farm Fresh Broadband by Professor Christopher Alley. Pretty fascinating and very learned material. Some of the early pieces in it to sort of lay the groundwork, the future belongs to the connected. And the current need for broadband is equivalent to the need for electricity and telephones once before. Fiber is as essential as bran flakes. I mean, is that the point? Or obviously someone, you, are saying that's where we are now. That's the true need for broadband in today's world.
Yeah, you know, and I don't think it's an exaggeration. I don't think it's an exaggeration when President Biden said in March that broadband is the next electricity, or when chairperson of the Federal Communications Commission says that the future belongs to the connected. I mean, just look at what's happened during the last 2 years of the pandemic, when we were all asked to work and shop and learn and study from home. And that, by definition, required not just an access to the internet, but a high-speed, high-quality, affordable broadband connection. And it was through that so many of us were able to stay employed, we're able to book COVID vaccines, we're able to Skype or Zoom or FaceTime with our families, we're able to binge Netflix. I mean, all of this depends on broadband. But on the flip side, the pandemic also demonstrated how many tens of millions of Americans don't have access to something that so many of us take for granted. And that's really at the heart and soul of my book, is why do so many rural Americans lack access to the internet in a time in which it's been described as a human right, not just, you know, something nice to have.
We'll talk about that. What are some statistics on the number of Americans not having access to broadband?
Well, that is a great question. And it's actually also quite a contentious question, because the honest answer is we don't know. And we don't know because the Federal Communications Commission has designed their kind of counting methodology in a way that tends to overcount connected people. So what that means is the Federal Communications Commission might say that, you know, this country is 98% connected, that 98% of Americans have access to a broadband connection. More realistic portraits paint that at about half of it. So Microsoft, for instance, has said that 120 million Americans, that's roughly one-third of the country, does not have access to the internet at broadband speeds. So wouldn't be able to, for instance, stream Netflix. Another statistic has said that at least 42 million Americans do not have access to an internet connection at home. 42 million Americans, and that's the number I tend to use in my book and in my research, which is way more than, you know, 2% of the country. So the Federal Communications Commission has really exaggerated how many connected people are here in the United States.
Well, talk about that for a minute. You talk about the FCC exaggerating the number. I'm assuming, based on my reading of the book, Farm Fresh Broadband, that you're talking about census blocks. Is that correct?
I am. And here's the crazy story. So the Federal Communications Commission is in charge of every year reporting on broadband connectivity. It's part of their mandate, right? And for listeners out there, the Federal Communications Commission is the national agency in charge of regulating communication. And so every year they come up with this report called the Broadband Deployment Report. And how they measure connectivity is that they ask internet service providers, you know, like Comcast Xfinity or CenturyLink or AT&T, to report on how many people they've connected in every area of the United States. But how they measure that, they don't go address by address or house by house or business by business. Instead, they start with what's called the census block. And a census block is maybe a neighborhood, maybe a couple of streets, but it's more than just a house or even more than just a street. And what the Federal Communications Commission has said is that so long as one building in a census block has access to broadband or can be served with broadband within 10 business days, then that entire census block is considered 100% served. So I'll give you an example. I live in Locust Grove in Charlottesville. So if one building in Locust Grove has broadband, the entire neighborhood is considered served, even if everyone else doesn't have access. And so that's what I mean that the FCC has exaggerated how many people are connected because we go by the census block level.
And how does that work for more rural areas and states?
Well, for rural areas, so like I said, a census block in a city, maybe like Charlottesville, is a neighborhood. In New York, it might be a couple of streets because it's so dense. In rural areas, sometimes it's an entire town or a couple of towns because it's measured by density. So what that means is that entire towns, sometimes entire counties, are finding themselves, quote-unquote, served with broadband, according to the FCC, but not at all served in practice. And the implications for this are tremendous, because once you are considered served, once a census block is considered served by the FCC, that census block is no longer eligible for federal support. And one of the things we've learned about broadband is that it's very expensive to deploy. I mean, fiber optic cables, which are the gold standard of broadband, you know, super high speed, super reliable, super durable, that's at least $27,000 a mile and upwards of $100,000 a mile in some areas. So a lot of counties need federal support to get broadband going. But if they're considered served by the FCC, then they're not eligible for any of this support. And there's now $65 billion that is going to be coming from the federal government for broadband. So we need to make sure that if you're unconnected or underconnected, that the maps reflect that and don't count you as served.
Well, how does the United States compare to other countries?
Well, not well. I think we're sitting between 10th and 20th in the world in terms of connectivity. I'm not 100% sure of that number. But I think the interesting thing is let's compare the United States to countries like Canada and Australia. And I say that because all three of these countries deal with the same issue, and that is huge amounts of sparsely populated rural and remote areas. Because oftentimes we compare the United States to a country like South Korea, and we say, well, South Korea is, you know, 100% served with super fast broadband. But that's not a really good comparison because South Korea is so urban. It's so built up. They don't have to deal with massive areas like the grain belt. So if we look at countries like Canada and Australia, we actually find that most countries that have large rural areas are really struggling with connectivity. So we're not doing any better or any worse than Canada and Australia. And I think that's really the benchmark here. And so when we think about strategies to deploy broadband in rural areas, there's a lot we can learn from the Canadian and Australian examples as well.
Do we know how Russia and China are doing? And I ask that because to me it seems that they would have similar issues, large countries with some low population areas, but not necessarily free with their statistics and numbers.
Well, and that's exactly the problem, is that those would also be comparative countries in terms of geography. But because we don't have reliable information coming out of the regulator in either of these countries, we can't exactly make a comparison. I mean, oftentimes, and certainly the former presidential administration had talked about this race to 5G against China, that we are losing the race to 5G against China. But, you know, that was all rhetoric. There is no race because there's nothing to race towards, just kind of political hype. And so, they would be great comparisons if we had accurate information coming from them.
Professor Christopher Alley here today as we talk about his book, Farm Fresh Broadband and the Rural and Urban Digital Divide, today. So, Professor, the United Nations called digital divide a matter of life and death. So how are poorer countries managing, or are efforts being made by countries other than the G8 or G20?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we know about the digital divide is that it is not a uniquely American issue. It's not even a uniquely urban issue. There are multiple digital divides that permeate this country or this world. And so, for instance, who is not likely to have access to the internet at home, right? We're talking, yes, rural, also low-income communities, oftentimes minority communities, tribal and indigenous communities, LGBTQ communities, English language here in the United States speaking communities. I mean, so the digital divide, or the multiple digital divides, tends to track onto all of these other forms of social and economic inequality that we've got, and that is replicated throughout the world. I'm right now doing a study of all 38 countries in what's called the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And that includes, you know, very wealthy countries like Germany, and it includes not so wealthy countries like Costa Rica. And one of the really interesting things I'm seeing is that all 38 of these countries are investing in one way or another in their broadband networks. So I think, you know, that's one of the really important things that we need to take note of is that this is not just a wealthy country issue, and it's also just not the wealthy countries who are responding. But every country, at least in my study, is doing what they can to ensure connectivity. And I think that really demonstrates exactly what you said, quoting the UN, that access to the internet is a matter of life and death, particularly during a pandemic.
So some of the statistics in the book, you go back to comparison of electricity to broadband and how electricity was needed, and it grew through one manner, and broadband, and where it stands now in its growth. In 1920, 39% of rural farms had a phone, but only 33% of urban homes had a phone. So why has this flip-flopped in the sense of 100 years ago, phones were more popular or more needed in a rural farm than on an urban center, but broadband is more easily found in an urban location than a rural location?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, I do a lot of work, like you said, comparing the history of electrifying the countryside and bringing telephone out to the countryside and the kind of the failure to do so with broadband today. And one of the major things that I see is that in 1935, the Roosevelt administration created what was called the Rural Electrification Administration. And it was a very well-funded organization, eventually became part of the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA. And it had a mandate to connect rural communities with electricity, first with electricity, and then later on in the late 1940s, it was with telephone. And one of the things the REA did was privilege cooperatives, local cooperatives. And if you look at the history of telephone, particularly in rural areas, a lot of it was not, you know, AT&T who was the monopoly provider. It wasn't AT&T coming into these rural areas. It was farmers coming together and forming a cooperative to bring telephone to their communities. And that's what happened. That's what the REA encouraged with electricity and then again with telephone in the 1940s and 1950s. So one of the things that I argue in my book is that we took a distinctly, and by we, I mean federal policymakers, took a very local approach to delivery, right? Let's fund and incentivize the formation of cooperatives. We don't, you know, they saw a need for this to be local and grassroots. You jump ahead 100 years, and the history of broadband funding has largely favored the largest providers, the national carriers. We've given hundreds of millions of dollars to these national providers to connect the country, and they've largely failed to do so. So one of the major arguments, and this is, you know, a bit of a spoiler alert for anyone who is thinking about buying my book, is that I argue that local broadband is the best broadband. Because it, when broadband is provided by cooperatives and local and regional providers or municipalities or counties, it's more accountable, it's faster, it's cheaper than the national providers. I mean, just look what's going on in our own backyard, right? From Nelson County, the Central Virginia Electric Cooperative, CVEC, and their Firefly broadband company, they're doing amazing work. So many electric cooperatives here in Virginia are doing amazing work connecting their communities. So I really, really think and argue and advocate for the need for a local solution to the digital divide.
You were talking about AT&T. I don't remember what year it was. I'm sure you will, in the early 1980s, possibly. AT&T was identified as being a monopoly, and you mentioned that there were 14,000 telephone companies, not just AT&T, although the 14,000 telephone companies were mostly rural. So what was the change in effect from bringing about this antitrust agreement?
So AT&T was broken up in 1984, between 82 and 84. So if we look at the history of telephone, yes, there was a lot of very small rural companies, and oftentimes they'd have maybe 12 telephone connections. 12 houses were connected, and they were considered a company, right? So that's the scale we're talking about when we look at 14,000. What AT&T had, though, was a monopoly on cities and county seats, also long distance. So, you know, if any form of business communication you wanted to have, if you wanted to call the neighbor, maybe you weren't using an AT&T line, but any form of business, any form of you know, kind of outside of your neighborhood communication, this was done through AT&T. Oftentimes, actually, in the 1940s, people in rural areas would have two telephones, one serviced by a rural cooperative, and that was just to call around the neighbors, and then another one with AT&T to make outside phone calls. So AT&T was absolutely a monopoly going into the 1980s, because you really couldn't do anything other than chat with your neighbors if you weren't going to use AT&T.
All right, let's take a break here, and we will be right back to talk more with Professor Christopher Alley about broadband and the rural and urban digital divide. We'll get into that divide a little bit and how it comes about and how it's identified in more than just one way, rural and urban. Be right back. And thank you for being here with us again. Sunday morning wake up call here on a Sunday. Professor Christopher Alley with us today talking about broadband. Farm Fresh Broadband is his book. You can pick it up. So, Professor, as we were talking about being on a farm, wanted to have broadband, you had a story about a farmer, Nelson Schneider. Tell us that.
Yeah, so this is, This is a farmer in the Midwest, and it's how I actually opened my book with a vignette. And this farmer wanted broadband to his farm. I mean, this is not unusual, right? Broadband is going to fuel the next generation of agriculture. And his provider, which was Windstream, and Windstream is one of the large telephone companies that now provide internet, was going to charge him over $300,000 to bring fiber optic cables to his farm. $300,000, and which is ridiculous, and well beyond the national average for broadband. But I think it also demonstrates how some of these large companies, they don't, you know, really care about connectivity. What they care about is making a profit. So eventually, the Schneider farm opted to go with a cooperative who charged, you know, maybe 10% of that amount. As I write my book. So, you know, huge difference. But again, talking about the importance of local providers rather than national ones. So eventually, the Schneider farm was charged $41,000 rather than $383,000, which is, you know, egregious to say the least. But the difference between a national provider and a local provider.
Still, I mean, you're talking about $41,000. I think if every home in the Charlottesville Albemarle area that wanted broadband was handed a bill for $41,000, we would gag, and very few people would sign up.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, I shouldn't say that $41,000 is appropriate, but it is more in line with the national average. And this is some of the problems we're seeing with broadband in remote areas, particularly the farms. So you might have a fiber optic cable that's going down a highway, for instance, right? We often use highways to lay fiber. So you've got this fiber optic line going through a highway, and maybe you've got these little split off points. But if your driveway is 2 miles from a highway, which is, you know, not unusual in rural areas, if your driveway is at 2 miles, they're going to try and charge you per mile to bring that fiber optic connection, because they don't see, and by they, I mean large providers, don't see that return on investment, right? So if they're paying $27,000 a mile, you're going to get billed for all of that. And that's one of the problems when we think about broadband purely as like a consumer good, as a commodity, rather than as an essential service. And one of the interesting things that I found in my research is the way that cooperatives, the telephone and electric cooperatives, approach broadband. They see it as an investment in the community. So they are much more willing to take a very long-term look on return on investment, 10, 20 years, rather than, you know, these large providers who want the quarterly return on investment. And, you know, connecting one farm is not going to bring the quarterly profits that them and their shareholders want. And so they're going to stick the farmer with the bill. And I've seen this story repeated throughout the country. Someone wants broadband. Someone knows the importance of broadband. A major provider says, yeah, sure, we'll do it for $27,000 a mile.
Yeah, one of the phrases that I think I found in the book was called the importance of accessibility, not just availability. And that's what you're talking about here, correct, with Farmer Schneider.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, so broadband was available, right? It was available to him if he wanted to spend, well, $383,000. But let's look at that on a micro scale. I mean, think about it for low-income families. The United States pays the most for broadband out of any country in the OECD. We pay $84 a month on average. $84 a month. That is a tremendous amount of money. That's a tremendous amount of money for anybody. But if we think about low-income families, if we think about families who have been devastated by the COVID-19 pandemic with job losses, perhaps loss of life, I mean, that becomes, you know, a huge burden. And so, yes, is broadband available to these households, to these families? Yes, it's available. Is it actually accessible? No, because it's not affordable. And that's one of the major problems we have here in the United States, is how much broadband costs per month.
Well, how do you make it less expensive? I mean, are you talking about, is the answer to all of this just make small co-ops and let it happen?
Well, no, because broadband in particularly rural and remote areas is always going to be what economists call a market failure. Right. There's not enough people in rural areas to turn a profit. Right. So we're always going to need federal support. And one of the things that's pretty exciting about the infrastructure bill that just passed, or passed in November, rather, is that it allocated $65 billion for broadband, $42 billion of which would go to subsidized deployment, like getting the fiber optic cables in the ground or strung up on telephone poles. But $14 billion is also going to create a subsidy for low-income households, so their broadband bills will be offset by $30 a month. And that's going to be transformative for a lot of low-income houses who, you know, were trying to juggle, is it groceries or is it a broadband subscription, right? And we think this is, you know, quaint. Why would you choose broadband? But, I mean, this is how kids are getting educated during the pandemic, right? This is how we're working. This affordability program, which is going to be administered by the Federal Communications Commission, is going to be tremendous at $30 a month for low-income families.
All right. So you're talking about how money is being spent by recent bill passage. So a couple quick questions, please. Again, Professor Christopher Alley here, UVA's Department of Media Studies, as we talk about broadband, his new book, Farm Fresh Broadband. You can find that in multiple areas. Please pick it up if this is an interesting topic for you. I found it quite fascinating. So in 2009, there was the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Lots of money was allocated for rural broadband. Do you remember how much or general figure?
$7.2 billion went to broadband in the Recovery Act, and this was to get us out of the Great Recession.
Okay. And the Build Back Better plan, which was just recently passed, has how much allocated towards broadband?
Well, Build Back Better, I think it's what's better to look at is the infrastructure package. Which is different from Build Back Better. But infrastructure package had $65 billion for broadband. $65 billion. Yeah.
So how was the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, how was that $7.2 billion spent? What was done with it?
Well, it was, and I, you know, the other thing your listeners might find interesting is that we've been spending money between 2009 and 2021 as well. The Federal Communications Commission spends $5 billion a year subsidizing broadband deployment. So between 2009 and 2017, the federal government has allocated $47 billion to broadband, which begs the question, I think is where you're going, why do we still have a digital divide if we are spending all of this money? So the Recovery Act money went to two agencies, USDA, and through what was called the Rural Utilities Service, which was a division of USDA, and the other went to an organization called the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the NTIA. And USDA did make some very important connections. They brought broadband out, but there was also some waste. And part of the problem here was that USDA, and you know, for those who are reading my book, USDA actually ends up being a champion in my book. But they did not do a great job being a steward of this public money. Part of it was because they didn't have the staff. The other part of it is that it was really rushed. Congress did not give USDA a lot of time to spend this money. So some of the funds got returned and some people did not get connected. And so, you know, one of the takeaway lessons, I think, from the book is we need to make sure that history does not repeat itself. Another example I'll give is the Federal Communications Commission, which started funding broadband in 2014, 2015. And rather than, you know, so they've got this fund of $5 billion and that consumers pay into, by the way, you can look on your telephone bill. It's called the Universal Service Fund, and we all pay into it. $5 billion for broadband deployment in rural high-cost areas. And rather than make it a competitive bidding process where companies could compete, they selected the 10 largest telecommunications companies and just gave them a ton of money. CenturyLink, for instance, got $505 million a year for 6 years. So we can see how, you know, the FCC has historically and policymakers have historically just favored these giant companies and really place local communities at a disadvantage. And that's one of my biggest concerns when we're looking at spending $65 billion is we need to make sure that the rules are in place to make sure we've got accountability for this money, but also that more than just the largest providers are going to be able to access some of this money. Because in the end, like I said, it's been the local and regional companies that have been doing most of the high quality connections, not, you know, the big national providers.
And what are your honest expectations? I mean, yeah, you said something along the lines of, I hope and things they should do, they should, but what are your honest expectations for government policy and large spending bills?
I'm optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to learn from past mistakes, and a couple of reasons why. One is that most of this money is actually going to the NTIA and not the FCC. So the FCC, like I said, has kind of traditionally favored these giant large companies. NTIA did a decent job back in 2009 when it got its Recovery Act money. So they're changing the administrators for this money, and hopefully that will make a difference. And I think it's an acknowledgement that the FCC has not been a good steward of consumer money. The other thing is there is some language in the Infrastructure Act, not as strong as I would have liked it to be, but it says that the NTIA, in writing the rules around who can access this $42 billion for broadband deployment, that it can't discriminate against local providers, against cooperatives, against nonprofits, against municipalities. Now, I would have loved to have seen language that said, hey, you should favor these entities, because that's what the Rural Electrification Administration did back in the 30s and 40s. It favored local cooperatives. That language wasn't there, but at least there's language that says that you can't discriminate against them. So right now, the NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, is writing the rules around how states can access the $42 billion that's going to go towards broadband deployment. And so I'm watching them carefully. I'm attending their webinars. I'm reading their documents, trying to make sure that as best as I can, that I understand what's going on and can hold them accountable to making sure that this money is actually going to the communities, to the states, to the companies that are doing the connections. Because one of the things I argue, you know, in the book is that at the end of the day, broadband is not actually about companies or policymakers or policy or technology even. Broadband is about people. And I think that's the thing we learned also during the pandemic, is that broadband is about people, and we need to make sure that we're getting broadband to the people who need it.
Professor Christopher Alley here again as we're talking about broadband. Professor, you mentioned that the digital divide is not just rural and infrastructure. You talk in the book about how in an urban setting, it's about the income gap and the cost for lower SES versus a higher income group. Can you speak about that for a sec?
For sure. And so this is kind of going back to what I had mentioned, that the digital divide is not just rural urban, but it kind of exists everywhere. And it's intersectional in that, you know, if you're rural and low income, you're more likely not to have broadband than if you're rural and high income. But particularly the income issue is seen in urban areas where there are just, quite frankly, more people, right? Let's look at New York City, for example. 18% of New York City, 18% of New York City does not have a broadband subscription at home. Now, I bet you dollars to donuts that that's not because there isn't a wire that's connected, right? It's an affordability issue, right? That's a huge amount, 18% of residents of New York City, in a city of you know, several million people. And so we are seeing the digital divide exist amongst low-income communities in urban areas. The other thing we see, particularly in urban areas, is under-connection. So, the kind of technology that was deployed in a lot of urban areas may not have been updated in a long time. So it might be, for instance, what's called a DSL, a digital subscriber line connection. These are twisted telephone wires. And, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s, this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. This was the way we got high-speed internet. Nowadays, however, DSL connections just can't possibly keep up with our digital demands. Nevertheless, DSL is one of the most prominent technologies right up there with cable. And so we see a lot of underconnection going on throughout the country in rural and urban areas. So one of the big concerns is, you know, when we're rolling out all of this money, are those who are underconnected but still, you know, served on that infamous FCC broadband net we were talking about, are they going to fall further behind? Because, you know, sure, they've got access to the internet, but their connections are so poor that they can't really do anything with it or can't really take advantage of it as we do who take the internet for granted. So there's a lot of moving parts to fixing the many digital divides that exist in this country.
When you speak about the urban divide being income and cost for broadband, my brain trickles into what we've been experienced during COVID and the virtual teaching, especially in the public school system. My memory is that when all this first started back in, where are we now? I'll say spring of 2019, that Charlottesville and Albemarle County were giving hotspots to lower income families who weren't already hooked up to broadband so that their kids could actually hook up to the school system. Is that correct?
It is correct. And it wasn't just to low income families. It was also to rural families who didn't have a connection at home. And again, we see how the digital divide is not just rural and not just low income. You know, it's kind of everywhere where we see, you know, the folks who have been maybe disenfranchised before. So yeah, Charlottesville and Albemarle did have a hotspot program. Louisa County actually experimented with solar powered public hotspots. So, you know, they put up a solar powered hotspot in a park, for instance, that people could access. Some counties experimented with putting a Wi-Fi router on a school bus and then parking it in a low income area. And that school bus would then, you know, kind of create like a hotspot. So we saw a lot of really interesting innovation, particularly to try and get school children access to the internet, because, you know, that's how schooling worked for the last 18 months, you know, kind of before the fall. But again, you know, demonstrating the crucial importance of broadband. But one of my takeaways is kind of the innovativeness of local communities. And that includes here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, and in Central Virginia. Some really interesting experimentation. But we need to get these kids broadband, affordable, high-quality broadband, so that this doesn't happen again. I think that's the other really important takeaway.
Professor Christopher Alley here with us today as we talk about broadband, the rural and urban digital divide. His new book, Farm Fresh Broadband. Hang tight. We'll be right back. And thank you for being here with us again on another Sunday morning. Again, we are talking about broadband here today. Professor Alley, I read in the book that the National Farmers Union, is that the proper organization? The National Farmers Union was and has been asking and pushing for federal and political assistance in getting broadband out to the rural community. And that's just one organization doing so. And the people are clamoring for it. So why aren't federal politicians doing it? It seems like every time it comes up in a spending bill, there is a battle about it.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm hoping, you know, if there was any bright spot that came out of the last 2 years of this terrible pandemic, is that conversation has kind of been put to bed. I mean, I think 2.5 years ago, when folks were arguing for broadband, particularly on Capitol Hill, you know, there is still some politicians who said, well, we don't really need to do this. It's a luxury. It's not a necessity. It's not a utility. It's not a need. It's a luxury. You know, the pandemic quickly nipped that line of rhetoric in the mud, so to speak, because we obviously learned that it's not a luxury. It is a necessity in modern life, particularly and crucially during a pandemic. I think one of the other fights we're seeing on Capitol Hill right now is the very definition of broadband. Here in the United States, we define broadband by speed. So the official definition of broadband is that broadband is an internet connection of at least 25 megabits per second download, 3 megabits per second upload. Now, that basically means that, you know, if you have that speed, you would be able to, for instance, stream Netflix and send a couple of emails, and you know, one person could probably do all right at 25.3. The problem, though, is what happens when we have households and multiple people needing to jump on a Zoom call, for instance, at the same time. If, you know, I'm teaching a class and my husband has to take a call, at 25.3, our connections are not going to be able to maintain two different Zoom calls, let alone, you know, the smart toaster and the smart air fryer we've got. And so there's been a battle at Capitol Hill to raise the definition of broadband from, let's say, 25.3, where it is right now, to maybe 100 megabits per second down and 20 megabits per second upload, or even, and this is what I argue, 100 megabits per second download, 100 megabits per second upload. That would allow a family, it would allow roommates, it would allow everybody to have kind of digital ease, and we wouldn't have to be worried about whether or not, if we were, you know, taking an exam, that our internet connection would conk out because someone else jumped on the line. And so that's really where we're seeing this massive political fight right now. Is I think we've all agreed that broadband is important, but what we haven't agreed on is what exactly broadband is and how much broadband does everybody need. And I've heard it described as, well, you know, let's just get something that's good enough out there to rural areas. You know, rural areas don't need a Lexus; they need a Camry, as one policymaker says. But the difference is, you know, if we look at the different types of technologies, we're not looking at the difference between a Camry and a Lexus. We're not talking about gold plating anything. We're talking about the difference between walking and driving. Right? And so we need to make sure that the connections that are going out to rural areas, to tribal areas, to low-income areas, it's just not what I call in my book good enough broadband, but that it's high-quality, high-speed, future-proof broadband that doesn't meet our needs of 2 years ago. It meets our needs of 10 years from now. Because the other thing we don't want to be doing is, you know, 10 years from now, investing another $65 billion in broadband because it turns out that we deployed subpar networks. Right? And that's where a lot of political fights are going in D.C.
Professor, you mentioned the Camry versus the Lexus issue, but one of the things that I found interesting was how broadband would be used in rural locations, broadband and farming. There was something called precision agriculture. Can you explain that to the listeners?
Oh, for sure. Precision agriculture is super cool. It's the next generation of automated agriculture. So it's the idea that, you could tether, for instance, a harvester and a tractor, and you could make them drive side by side so that, the harvester is harvesting and everything is getting captured by the tractor. It means that you can automatically steer a combine or a planter that therefore, doesn't allow for human error anymore. And so there's all of these really cool, innovative technologies. If you're on a dairy farm, you can have automated milkers, for instance. I was on a hog farm where the pens all had sensors underneath, and it would allow the hog farmer to figure out which hogs were eating properly and which hogs were drinking properly and which hogs weren't, and that was an indication of illness. I mean, super cool things that we're going to need to be doing to make agriculture more efficient and more ecological, but all of this requires a broadband connection because it requires the equipment to talk to each other through something called machine-to-machine communication. This, though, can't be done with, like, you know, a 2G or a 3G cell phone. This needs a high-speed connection. But the other interesting thing is that it needs a wireless connection, right? You can't be plugging in a fiber optic cable to every single tractor on a farm. So we need to be thinking about really innovative, high-speed wireless ways to deliver broadband as well. And here's just another example. There's something called variable rate technology. And what that allows is for soil analysis. So a farmer will get a map on their tractor, and it will be in three different colors, green, yellow, and red. And it tells the farmer how productive the soil is and maybe what more nutrients need to go in if it's a yellow area or if it's a red area. So it really allows them to maximize in an ecologically friendly way planting, which is super cool, but all of it needs broadband.
And now we know why Mr. Schneider wanted to spend $45,000 to put broadband to his farm.
Exactly.
I'm going to bring this up. You made mention that one of the politicians mentioned whether broadband was a necessity or a luxury. Somewhere in your book, and I'm going to paraphrase this a touch, you mentioned that broadband can be used for education, which we talked about, business, which we've talked about, telemedicine, Netflix, and porn. Well, we've mentioned Netflix. We'll disregard porn, but we haven't talked about telemedicine really, which over the past 2 years has become an ever-growing sector of our lives. So broadband, again, is necessary for that, especially in a rural area, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, rural communities are more or less likely, rather than urban community, to have easy access to doctors and nurses, for instance, right? So even simple things like checkups become a matter of telecommunications, right? If you need to jump online to speak to a doctor or a nurse about an ailment or to do a checkup, you know, we've been hearing reports of folks who are skipping screenings, for instance, or skipping annual physicals because they don't want to leave the house and, violate any social distancing protocols. Telemedicine, telehealth can rectify that. Even just basic things like record keeping, we need broadband for. Think about, how easily we email a document, right? We take that for granted. Certainly we do. That's not something taken for granted in a lot of rural areas where email is a luxury because the broadband connection either isn't there or is so painfully slow that you need to be sending your email at 2 o'clock in the morning to take advantage of the bandwidth. So everything from record keeping to basic diagnostics, then to, robotic surgery from a distance is possible with a high-speed internet connection. And as much as, robotics are super cool, for me, it's the mundane stuff. It's the record keeping. It's being able to get on the horn with your doctor or your nurse to talk about what's going on with your kids. All of this requires a high-speed internet connection.
I think I heard this story on NPR about Wise County, Virginia schools were getting together with SpaceX and Starlink so that they could beam broadband to the school system. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with the Wise deal, but I am very familiar with both with SpaceX and with Starlink, which is it's called the Low Earth Orbital Satellite System. And it differs from, we had satellite internet before, and that was provided by two companies, Viasat or HughesNet. And these were called geosynchronous satellites, and they were further away, and they are further away from Earth. And subscribers to Viasat or HughesNet, what was then satellite internet, have often complained of super slow speeds, super expensive bills, data caps that really prevent you from doing anything, and a huge amount of what's called latency, which is the delay it takes when you send a request and for it to come back. So, websites taking forever to load, for instance. So really making internet access unusable, despite the fact that you are paying, sometimes hundreds of dollars a month for it. Now here comes Elon Musk and SpaceX, and they launch, a couple thousand satellites into low Earth orbit. And the idea behind that was that they would be able to provide faster connections. And originally the hype was that they could compete with fiber optics even. One of the things I do in my book is caution my readers to be mindful of the hype of the new and the next. And certainly Starlink is going to do some good, particularly for remote areas where, you know, broadband is really hard to come by and really hard to reach. But, you know, what worries me is when I talk to counties and communities who say, well, we think Starlink is just around the corner, so we're not going to do any broadband planning. And to be honest, Starlink for most of us is not just around the corner. It's very selective in what communities they go to. It's very selective in what households they go to. So it is going to be a component. It is going to play a role in bridging the digital divide, but it's not going to be the end-all and be-all of broadband access. Mark my words on that one.
So you mentioned earlier Nelson County. They have a broadband authority. They are set up now to provide service to all in a very challenging county. I'm curious to get your thoughts on how Albemarle County does the same. And for those who aren't aware of the size of Albemarle County and the disparity in the geographic area, we're talking about from Esmont to Boonesville and Batesville to Sismont. How do you match what's being done elsewhere?
Well, Nelson did a couple of things very right very early. First of all, they were thinking about broadband way before a lot of other counties in Virginia. And in fact, you know, Nelson really is at the forefront of high-speed, affordable broadband connectivity. They also had the advantage of CVEC, the Central Virginia Electric Cooperative, who also wanted to get into broadband. And so Nelson County encouraged CVEC. They gave whenever they had extra money or federal dollars, they funded CVEC and through Firefly Broadband. And now we're seeing Firefly, you know, move outside of Nelson into neighboring counties, including Albemarle, but also including, I believe, Appomattox and Louisa and other Central Virginia areas as well. So you saw this great partnership between a cooperative, an electric cooperative, and the county really early on, certainly in the last few years. And then, you know, if you look at how much money Nelson County gave from its CARES Act appropriation, right, every county got some money, and Nelson County gave, I think, upwards of 50% of its allocation to broadband, to Firefly, demonstrating the importance that Nelson County placed on fiber optic connectivity. And that is just super cool and super forward-looking, and I can't praise them enough for what they did. I mean, Albemarle has a broadband authority. Albemarle is massive, right, and comes with its own unique challenges, and we also don't have a kind of domestic or local electric cooperative, right? Certainly here in Charlottesville, most of us are on Dominion. But they've also started to take advantage of some interesting partnerships. Dominion is piloting a broadband program, not to be a retail broadband provider, but to kind of be what's called the middle mile, to allow a retail broadband provider to use its network to bring broadband to people's homes. And Firefly is also moving into Albemarle County as well. But certainly things are much slower going here in Albemarle than they are in Nelson County. So there's a lot to learn from Nelson.
What happens when technology moves beyond broadband? I mean, we've gone a long way from phones to basic computers to broadband. Is that so far away that it's foolish to be thinking about that at the moment when we haven't solved the initial problem?
Well, I think, you know, this is why we need to be deploying, you know, what the phrase I kept using is future-proof. So not using the technologies of the 90s and the 2000s, but really looking to fiber optics and what I call kind of fiber-fueled fixed wireless, which is what happens when you have a fiber optic cable that goes to a tower, and then that tower uses radio waves to deliver broadband to people's homes. It really needs to be a fiber or fiber-backed fixed wireless solution. We can no longer be dependent upon telephone wires. So that's my biggest concern is we got to get rid of these telephone wires, get rid of these DSL connections, and start moving aggressively towards fiber and fiber optic fixed wireless. That's going to be the future. That's what's going to make sure that the next generation of connectivity happens. Is, like I said, it's not about connecting us with our needs from 2 years ago, but it's anticipating our needs 10, 20 years down the line. The really cool thing about fiber optics is that it can handle an almost unlimited capacity of data. So for a lot of, you know, for 20 years, you won't need to rip up the fiber optic cable. You'll need to change some of the electronics that are delivering the network. But the cable itself will be able to handle basically whatever we throw at it for the next 20 years. So that's why we need, you know, a fiber first or a fiber with fixed wireless solution and kind of get rid of these other technologies.
So, Professor, you have about 2 minutes left. Can you tell us the story about Rock County, Minnesota?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So this is a great story. So one of the things I realized when doing my research, and, like, you know, I'm a policy scholar. I read a lot of policy documents, and I was thinking, well, you know, maybe people don't find broadband policy as fascinating as I do, and I really need to humanize broadband to my reader. And so my hound dog, Tuna, and I drove 3,600 miles across the country talking to people about broadband, and we ended up spending some time in Rock County, Minnesota, which is in the southwest pocket of the state bordering South Dakota and Iowa. Rock County is the most, or at the time, was the most connected county in Minnesota. And they did this through a partnership with a telephone cooperative from South Dakota. They did that with money from the state. And they did that through a bond using a wind turbine tax revenue and bonded that over 10 years. So with $12 million at hand, Rock County, population around 10,000, now has 99% fiber to the home. Which is just awesome. And it was all because of these incredible local digital champions, a county administrator and a board of supervisors who were passionate about connectivity, passionate about fiber optic connectivity, and passionate about their local community. And I just think it's a great story. There's so much to learn from Rock County. County seat is Laverne. It's the nutcracker capital of the Midwest. And a great story for I think also for counties here in Virginia who are interested in what a meaningful partnership and what meaningful connectivity looks like.
You drove 3,600 miles?
Yeah, we drove from Charlottesville through parts of the Midwest to Missouri, then up to Winnipeg, Canada, and back.
By the way, I'm a big fan of hound dogs. I'm blown away that you made all that happen. And Rock County, Minnesota, sounds like.
Rock County, yep. We called it the Rural Broadband Road Trip and documented it all on Twitter. It had a hashtag. It was great. It was a wonderful July in 2018.
Again, Professor Christopher Alley here today. The Rural and Urban Digital Divide. You can find Farm Fresh Broadband out on your bookshelves. Look for it locally. Support the local bookstores. Ask for them to bring it in. If you're in a hurry, you don't want to go out, Amazon will drop it at your door if you need. Professor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, great. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.